and sharing what we're doing as opposed to it's all proprietary. So just a lot more of that sort of collaboration, I think, is something, is a direction that would be useful. Bonnie talked about sort of supporting instructors, and I would say instructors, administrators, all of the levels. I think that we need a community that is digitally fluent, who are comfortable and understand what is involved, not just because I'm saying it's good for the learners, but because we live in a digital world. And I think that as a community, the ESL community is not quite there yet. We have lots of people who are active, and I look at how many people are here. This is great, actually, for 4 to 5 on Saturday afternoon at Lake Louise. So I wasn't expecting this many people.
Get a life.
Nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
So we do have some strong advocates. But I think I think as a community, as a whole, we still have to bring some of our colleagues along with us, and not just the teachers. It's the administrators and the program managers, and they need to understand what's going on too. And to do that, we need to be literate ourselves. So that's an area I think we could move on. The other another one is just programming, and again, it's been touched on in terms of the content of our courses has to evolve and be relevant to today's world. So these technical tools that we use and different ways of communication, is that we're teaching not just grammar, as we know, we're teaching about communication. And to communicate in this world, what do we need to teach? And it needs to include the digital tools that we use to communicate with. So I think those need to be incorporated, and that we need to include the idea that if learners are showing up in our classrooms with smartphones and with tablets, and they are plugged in, and we don't provide them with the language and the skills to use them, we're losing them, and we're not doing them any favors. And if they're showing up unplugged, we're not helping them by not helping them to understand, to plug in enough to at least participate. And finally, I think we really need to foster a need for creativity and innovation. Of course, as I said earlier, that's the area I work in, so maybe I should have said that first. But a vibrant, robust climate of research, of experimentation, of tolerance for risk and ambiguity, which our government is not good at, I will have to say. But exploring how we can use technology to help our learners, and how we need to help our learners to use technology to communicate. And I just want to use this also to say, I'm not advocating replacing what we do well. What we do well doesn't need to be fixed. But we could be doing things better in some areas, because we know that it doesn't work really well. Maybe technology can help us. I'm not encouraged by looking at ways of using technology to do what we do face-to-face. If it works face-to-face, let's do it face-to-face. But that we know that doesn't meet all the needs. So let's explore technology to make us do better what we already are doing well.
Thank you. Did anyone else on the panel like to respond to
I actually just have a question about government, and have to preface that by saying, hey, how cool is it? A prime minister who is a teacher? Yeah, that's gotta be good. Yeah. Yeah. I know, we're in Alberta, I forgot, sorry. Yeah. Anyway, but I did wonder about the change in governments. Does that have an impact on your work? Because, you know, they're municipal, federal, provincial, they're always changing. Does it impact on your continuity?
Yes, of course, it definitely impacts. That's why I said we are government, and that is one of our challenges. Yes, it does, because it if directions, priorities shift according to our leadership, right? And so we keep doing the best we can for our little areas within government and advocating for our needs, but it does depend upon, it's not just which government, it can also be at what time, you know, in terms of what's going on elsewhere and competing priorities. It might be a priority, but something comes up that's a greater priority. So there's all kinds of things that play into that. So, I think that our new government here in Alberta, we're waiting. We're sort of in that position of getting to know, okay, what are you? And they are learning from us.
Yeah.
So, I mean, public service feeds into that. But ultimately, they're the leadership. So, yes, it does add to it adds to the mix.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, great. Thank you very much, Dean. Our next,
yeah.
I will push your button in a minute.
Whoa. This is the guy who said images are a devolution. He has slides.
Yeah.
That's right. So we're going to switch things up a little bit with Ken, and we're just going to switch over to Ken.
Yeah. All right. Okay, actually, I just want to start with Diane first. And Diane, you probably know this, TESOL Quarterly. How many articles are, what percentage is rejected every year? 80, 90?
Yeah, it's high.
I was thinking 92, somebody told me, but anyway, kind of high. Anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit about what should academic journals do differently in the digital age? I'm not against language or using images. I embrace it. My PhD is in computer-assisted language learning. But I am disturbed by journals, and I've got two here. One is the TESOL Canada, one on your right. That's last year's journal. And the other one is the first journal, the first scientific journal published in France in 1678. I would say they look fairly similar, yeah, disturbingly so, actually. And it bothers me, it drives me nuts that we live in this age where basically it is not adopted. Well, why haven't journals adopted more of an online presence? Well, even if they do, they tend to do something like the TESOL Canada Journal. What all they do is they put up PDFs. The PDFs of the journal go up. And that's pretty well all that you see. You go through all that sort of rigorous process of vetting and whatever else. But what if it could have multimedia? And this is a new paradigm, essentially, I'd like to suggest that could happen and eventually will happen. And the first thing that I think about is this idea of 92% of articles being sent to places being rejected. Well, that's often just because they have that much space. It doesn't mean that 92% of them are not fit to print. It's just that, we only have 120 pages, that's all we're going to print. So, sorry, even though you have, you know, the most stunning, fabulous, innovative idea in the world, we just can't do it. So there's a few things that I'd like to change. The first one is in the TESOL Canada Journal, there's something, there's one study, only one, that actually has any subjects in it. And increasingly in journals, we see a rehashing. We're eating our dead and sort of regurgitating it over and over and over again. So there's referential without any new research. Why is that? Well, it's often the case because we don't have students anymore. When we were all teaching primary school, before we sort of became professors or, you know, move up our level to where we are truly academics, we had lots of access to students. And sometimes as we get further up the ladder, we don't. I have graduate students, and I was in Bogota a couple of years ago with 58 of them, and so of course I, you know, used the opportunity to experiment on their minds and do something around authenticity. But what I'd really like to see are tests, are experiments with 100,000 subjects, not 32. So why 32? Why do we do 32? That's as many students as you have in your class. So they become your test subjects over and over again. So these small numbers. But actually, the work that I did is easy to replicate. I could put up the same, the same questionnaire, the same documents, everything else, and I could tell you how to how to administer that. And if I put that up online, I can start getting teachers not just in, you know, not just in Colombia, but all over the world doing it. And then you really start to get some interesting kind of data coming in, and some data which is worthy of advocacy. And one of the big problems we have is who's talking to the federal, who's talking to these governments other than you, and I'm so glad you are, who's talking to the governments advising them? And the example we've been discussing earlier today was the Syrian refugees. Okay, 25,000 Syrian refugees, who's going to teach them? Well, I know who's going to teach them. They're going to bring out kindergarten teachers out of retirement to volunteer, and that's basically what's going to happen. It happened with the Vietnamese boat people when they came. It was a disaster. A lot of that stuff going on. So the other thing I'd like to see in journals is an interactive element. So for example, if I was doing something and I was doing some kind of an experiment, why not add to the numbers and start put in the Excel sheet interactively? So you could try it with your own class and you could just add your numbers to this, or you could just see if you get the same sort of results. But putting in an interactive journal would have Excel sheets or any other kind of modeling software that would change the chart. So in essence, we're creating an organic document which would continue to change over decades because people could continue doing this. What made me think about this was when I first started teaching web-based courses, I was looking for an example of a survey, and I found there was something about mother-in-laws. And it was obviously from an Israeli, it was from an Israeli computer science student who said, "Do you like your mother-in-law? Yes or no," right? It was a stupid, stupid thing, but it had had 80,000 hits. 80,000 people had just stumbled onto it like I had and clicked it, right? Mostly no. And so, but obviously, if we harness those big numbers, that would be a big difference, right? I'd like to see annotations of what goes on. What do we do now? You publish a journal article, and then the journal comes out quarterly. So then, okay, oh, well, that means 3 months later, you might get a letter to the editor saying, "No, that's rubbish," or, you know, "No, this is actually incorrect or wrong." Why not have annotations that are more current? This is what students do in textbooks. They start adding their own notes. Sometimes those are useful, sometimes they're not. But again, it's a chance to discuss articles in real time. So a kind of discussion forum, very much what's happening now with things like letters to the editor, which I find are a brand new genre of great interest on their own, because it's not like the usual letter to the editor of one or two things. You know, they go on for 58 pages sometimes, people saying sometimes often very rude things, but some very insightful and interesting things. So I'd like to see more of that. Deeply linked articles. So right now, everybody goes on, they post an article, and it has 35 references, and 34 of them you're never going to find. They're locked up in libraries, or Elsevier or some other publisher has a fee-based system. Say, "Oh yes, you want to read this, you know, 10-page article, $35, you know, US, we take credit cards." It's too difficult. So really, if you really want to follow up on that stuff, unless you're a multimillionaire, you're not going to do it, or if you have access within a university library. Teachers don't have that. They don't have that quite often. So it's a barrier. It's a barrier to sharing the information. So I'd like to have an article where it really starts interlinking, having that hypertext and hypermedia. So you could go from that article, find the sources, find other studies, find related stuff, and that would build, because the audience would build it the same way they build things like Wikipedia building up. And that's sort of the model that I would like. And I'd also like to see it commented upon professionally. This is an example of the Talmud, and the Talmud has layers and layers and layers of comment going back centuries. So there, you know, there's all different. The actual text is that tiny little column in the center. Everything else is commentary on that by different scholars. And that's what I would like to see is, you know, when I write my article, yes, lots of people will discuss it, you all discuss it, but then Diane Larson Freeman's going to come in and put in that, you know, key points and sort of, you know, validate myself and what I've had to say or something else. So that's more or less, that's basically six ways I think that journals could, should, and will change. Okay? We could do better. Yeah. Okay. Comments?
Yeah.
I knew it. The socialist, yeah. Okay.
He doesn't even know me. But yes, I am a socialist, and yes, I am proud to be in a socialist province. Uh, my remark is, all of that stuff has already been invented. All of it. And has been in use for at least 10 years, some of it 20 years. Certainly I've used all of those things. So I think the relevant question here is, why hasn't it happened in journals? Right? And I think the answer lies in the ownership and the control of journals and the resistance to any model of journals that would make them be more open than they are. And frankly, I place the blame squarely on the publishers. But there has been a complicity on the part of academics as well. And we could have everything you said tomorrow without investing any money whatsoever if we switched to a system of publishing openly rather than in closed proprietary fashion, so that there is no more of this nonsensical pay $25 to read the article.
Can I just add a comment? I'm not sure if people in the audience are familiar with Dr. Tony Bates's teaching in the digital world, but he published it in the spring of this year as an OER, Open Educational Resource. It is, and there's space for comments. Highly, highly recommended. You can read it in many different formats, and he really has, I think, a lot to say.
Yes. Okay, just to comment on this, I do agree, and I do agree with the publishing. I mean, it drives me insane to try to find an article. At the same time, I must defend publishers, because I write many textbooks myself, and because I know the value that they add. Somebody asked me a question that I didn't know the answer to. I said, how many people work on your books, right? And I said, well, I write them, but I don't do all of it. And the context was, my wife's a painter. They said, well, does your wife do the illustration? I said, no, she doesn't touch it. And so I went back to my editor, and she didn't know either, but she added it up. Physically handling the book, like really working on it in the Pearson office, 27 people on this last book. They're spending $100,000, maybe $150,000 before they sell a single copy. That's going into permissions, that's going into the quality illustrations, the diagrams, the photographs, things that do cost money. Not everything is free, like on the internet. And, the editorial. I go through three levels of editing. Yes, I could publish a book online. Yes, I could try to market it. Yes, I could try to do all the market research that they do, visiting campuses right across the country. But, I can't. And so, I mean, don't knock the publishers. They do provide a lot of value. Yeah.
No, they don't. Sorry.
There
are like 15 million free images online, and you need the special one done for your book? Come on.
Okay, so Ken is going to address another question, so please go ahead.
Okay, so the second question is, will libraries die? Well, no, but a big but. So libraries are already dying in some ways. They're closing. If you followed in England, they've been closing libraries up and down the country, turning them into resource centers with, little laptops and things like that. But there's a few things happening here. Okay, so first of all, books last. Digital doesn't. When I was, I taught in Hong Kong for 12 years, and when I was finally clearing up my office and moving back to Canada, I came across a bunch of these large-scale floppy disks, and I had been through like two generations of computers. My computer didn't even take the little floppy disks anymore, and I sort of held it in my hand thinking, but this must be important, or I must have some interesting information, and I thought, I need a data archaeologist to extract this. I'm not sure where I'm going to figure out, how to get it off. I just heave them in the garbage. I think that's done. So digital keeps on changing all the time. So one thing libraries do with books is keep the data, and in some cases they update it. Bill Gates has a private company, a photo licensing company,
Corvus,
called Corvus, and he, in his business plan, he has updating the storage every 7 years. That's part of his business plan. And it's because when you think about it, we went from this to smaller floppy disks, to optical disks, CD-ROMs, all those things, and now we've got little USBs, and soon those will be gone as well. Okay, so the age of Google, it's about knowing what to look for. And this is what I find with students, my own students, even my graduate students, they often have a great deal of difficulty narrowing down a topic or expanding a topic in some cases. So it's easy to go and look online, but What librarians do and what libraries do is they organize information so that you can sort of see what's useful and what's not. I actually looked up something about Nazis because I knew it'd be contentious. This was the first hit that I got, actually, which is the American Nazi Party. And it just popped up first. And I can't remember. I may have put Nazi in some other word or America or something like that in there. But this is what came up, is join the American Nazi Party. If you have young students or immature students, you know, students who aren't well versed in the history of the world, you know, they can very likely go on to sources like this. So they need those critical thinking skills to discriminate between useful and not so useful information. Libraries do that already. They don't throw out this sort of stuff. You know, they'll have the protocols of the Elders of Zion. I mean, at York University when I was a graduate student, but they had it cataloged in such a way that you knew that it was a work of fiction and that it was propaganda, and it was surrounded by other books like that. So this sort of thing happens. They have to know how to synthesize in some ways. You know, too many students, they write by copying and pasting. And there's those wonderful things like Turnitin that sort of can help catch this. A university system that I worked with in Abu Dhabi, the Higher Colleges of Technology, required students to do this. It wasn't the teacher's prerogative. The students were required to put every piece of writing they handed in through Turnitin before they handed it in. It's not my problem, it's your problem. And then if the teacher did read it, did feel that it wasn't right, the student has signed off that they put it through Turnitin, and that's an automatic failure if it does turn out to be heavily plagiarized. But it's often they don't understand what plagiarism is because people take everything off the internet. Knowing when to stop is a major, major thing. So libraries tend to contain information, although they can't, you know, they can't keep it all current. And, you know, they tend to get into the whole book burning thing. They tend to, you know, decommission books that you think are maybe useful, but there's no room. They've got to make space. And, you know, that's wonderful that we have the web for that. But, you know, when we come up to something like this, World War II, Canada, 77 million, I read all of them. Yeah, no. How many are you going to read? When, you know, first page, second page, third page? When do you stop and how do you know how to narrow that down in some ways? So we have to teach critical thinking skills around all of this. And so that's really in terms of the libraries dying. Well, no, but they have to provide, help to provide those types of skills. And if they evolve into something new, it has to be something that organizes materials. That's what libraries have always done. B.F. Skinner said, education is what survives when what's been learned has been forgotten. We have a lot of information these days. We don't have enough wisdom. Stephen, I'm sure you want to disagree with all of that. Yeah.
One of the great things about being raised in a home of books was that when I was a kid, I had access to, they were the Penguin Classics. Brilliant set of books. And so, you know, before even I was in high school, I had read Robinson Crusoe, Swiss Family Robinson, and a bunch of other things, Whole Pilot's Flame and so on. The problem with those books is they lasted for one reading and then they fell apart and they were easily destroyed. I've always had books for my whole life. I'm one of those people who live in that particular generation that spans the digital era. Most of you are about my age and have had the same sort of experience. First half of your life was spent with books. The second half will be spent with digital. So I have a lot of books, and gradually my library is deteriorating through mist and mildew and little insects and cats. So books are not forever. They really aren't. The only thing that makes literature last forever is the possibility of replication. Almost nothing of the original sources from Plato to Anaximenes, whatever, you know, think of Paul Revere. Almost none of that exists. None of the original writings of the Bible exist. It's the possibility of copying. And that's what digital technology enables. Bill Gates can copy his library of 16 million images or whatever it is. I think it's a lot more than that, 6, 10 times. you could not possibly do that with the Louvre or the Library of Congress. Just not possible. You should not be surprised that when you searched for Nazi, you got Nazis. I'm sorry, but you searched for it, you found it. Although, you know, I'm not going to go there. Although, you know, there are ways in which you can find things that are somewhat more subtle than searching for Nazis on Google. You know, I agree with you that people need critical thinking skills. I think that they needed those skills before the digital era. And if there's one legacy of the print era that I won't lament, it's the fostering of this idea that there are authoritative texts and authoritative sources, and we know better than you what's good for you. I think the digital age is changing that. When you get 200,000 responses to a query, you have to make that kind of choice. We never had to in the past. You had like one book that told you everything. You had to take their word for it, even though it was misleading and false.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
There we go.
So now the fun part.
Yeah, the fun part. I'm just going to switch over here. So what we would like to be able to do, we've got about 15 minutes left during our session here, and we'd like to open it up to the floor. So if you have some questions that you have been saving to ask at the end of the session, please feel free to do so now. Our lovely panelists will be very happy to answer your questions, right?
I would like to know, what is the impact of technology on cognitive academic language learning? I know that social media and technology impacted positively basic English conversational skills, but impacted negatively the cognitive academic language learning. So what do you think?
Well, I know that there was just an MIT study done, just released about 3 or 4 days ago, and they said that students using laptops and lectures learn 40% less.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of a movement to sort of take it out. And I think it's, and Stephen will disagree with me, but...
you keep saying things that are not true.
Okay, well, Stephen knows better than MIT, so here we are. Let's pass it over to the
This is like hot potato.
I love that presumption of authority. Stephen knows more than MIT, as though no one could possibly know more than MIT. And MIT would never slant its results for anything corporate profit. Look, that study, they used the expression, and I quote, use a computer as their baseline measurement, without defining what they mean by use a computer. So use a computer could mean anything. So it's not surprising that you get such results. But that's one study. There isn't replication of it. There isn't, you know, the 100,000 subjects. If one of your classic 38 people in a graduate class kind of study, then you should be ashamed to cite it.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Are you feeling okay? You can start
it. I agree with the doctor.
I have like 10 questions, but I'm going to try to get down to one. I'm on your side boat. It's not a side boat, devolution. I don't know why emojis are new to you. If you had Facebook friends in Egypt and all over the world, they use them. And the reason a lot of my friends use them, they don't have enough language. We use it, it's fun. I use them, but I don't use it. I don't find language blunt. This is just my saying something. Now comes my question. I don't think language is blunt or abstract. It can be. Having sex can be good sometimes, but sometimes we need to talk to each other. And describing something is great with pictures, but sometimes we need to talk. So I don't quite. But what I want to talk about, you mentioned that one of the pitfalls, possible pitfalls of online learning by yourself. And a lot of what you said was great, I agree. But you said there's a problem too, you know, that when we help ourselves, where do we get direction from? And I don't think that 50 years ago, 100 years ago, yes, there were fewer people that maybe had access to things. People have always questioned. there have been major revolutions in societies because people question people. And just because 200,000 people answer, do you think that really means more people are thinking? I mean, when I read stuff online, and there is still a critical thinking component that we need to teach people. And okay, you say, well, who are you to decide that, right? But there's certain things that you read and you think, that's not a logical argument, it doesn't make sense to me, and you can disagree, but I don't think education is transmissive just because it's not online. I think that, so I'm wondering, like, I don't know what the rest of you think about that, but I just react viscerally to that. And not because I don't read computers. But that wasn't really a question, that's for Tom.
Any responses?
I can take it. Okay, emojis are new to me because I still remember the days of the first emoticons, colon, bracket, right? So emojis, they're more recent and therefore new. It's not like I discovered them this morning. What I discovered this week was Emojipedia, which is, and I think you can look it up, see, I can say that, which is a search engine for emojis. And I thought, oh, that's pretty interesting, because now they've somehow dictionaryized emojis. Two things I think are really true. I mean, totally take your point that people have questioned authority in history. Empirical evidence makes that obvious. But by the same token, especially now, we have this attitude that the printed word is somehow more responsible than the digital word. And I get that sense, and I certainly got it here, which is what makes me react. And if you sit down and look at, you know, the text of newspapers and magazines, going back 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, and so on, they're a pack of lies. Not 100%, not all the time, and not on every issue. But, you know, the printed word gave us William Randolph Hearst, and yellow journalism, and propaganda, and Mein Kampf, and the rest of it, right? So there was no end to the garbage that you could find in print. And it is therefore an unreasonable argument against digital content to say, well, it's not good enough.
That's not what I was saying.
No, but that's what he was saying.
No, I don't believe he was saying.
I think he was.
Okay.
I know he was. He put up the American Nazi Party. That was an exact case of that.
Okay. Thank you very much. This is going to be a lively discussion. It might continue past, but let's move on to another question.
I've been an IT practitioner for 30 years or so, and come out of the IT world, and have helped lots of businesses become successful using IT. And I came into education just in the last 3 or 4 years. And I look at the implementation of the technology and I see failure.
That's really bad.
And I just, I think it's too expensive. That's what I think is the problem. I'd like to get your comment on that. Like, relative to, a government spends $5,000 a term on a student to get them to a certain point, have we demonstrated adequately that $5,000, if we spend $5,500 because of the technologies, will we get 10% more result? That's really what's at issue. And I say this because that's my experience. You can't implement something that doesn't actually give more results, that you're going to have to spend more money to do it. So I think it's too expensive. So I'd like to get your feedback.
Let someone else have a shot first.
Well, a couple of things. I would say that, first of all, I don't disagree, it's expensive. But I'm not sure I would agree with how to measure the impact, because I don't, and this is just me personally speaking now, I'm not sure that, I guess it comes back to that, what I was saying earlier about, I don't see technology as replacing or doing what we're already doing well. I see that technology is a required component of learning to communicate in today's age. And therefore, it's not about getting a 10% more value because we put more money in. It's about, did we meet the needs of what the learners need to learn? And what they need to learn now is a little bit different. There is more, or it's changing and shifting. And so in order to have the tools to learn those things, they're going to need the technology. So I guess fundamentally I'm not sure I agree with that it needs to have it. If you invest 10% more, you're going to get a 10% more output. However, I do agree that it is expensive. And
I think that's how governments measure things. I think that's the issue. Governments measure.
Yeah, measurement.
Yeah, well, that's the whole George Bush thing with No Child Left Behind. Introduce standardized tests, and that will make teaching better, won't it? No, the superintendent of schools in Atlanta won the award out of all superintendent of the year, and died before she could go to jail. But another 180 teachers were fired or jailed for their, you know, they would tell, you know, the weaker students, oh, you can just stay home tomorrow, no need to come in, and they were caught, you know, redoing all the statistics or redoing all the multiple choice forms and things like that. But this whole measurement thing is all, it does drive me insane. And the metaphor that I use is, you're standing by a pool of water, you pick up a rock, you throw it into the center, there's a big splash, a while later the ripples hit. For things that I've been taught, you know, my grade 7 teacher, you know, told me something, I thought, well, I have no idea what he's talking about. But 7 years later, those ripples hit the shore, and I thought, uh-huh. And for all of us, we have those stories about somehow a teacher has touched us or taught us something. It may not be immediately measurable, but it doesn't mean that it's not good. In terms of the cost of the equipment, yeah, and governments governments are awful that way. When I was in Hong Kong, the big thing was open a computer lab. Any software possible? Can we get some money for software? No, because the computer lab was a photo opportunity. Software is never a photo opportunity.
I think, Jake, I totally get what you're saying, and I agree with you. Like, if there's an initial investment that is going to be huge, and in training, not just in the hardware, but the software, the training, all of those things. But I think, too, that the landscape is changing. We're really in a transition period, because the newest big thing is BYOD, right? Bring your own device. So if we design our teaching and learning context appropriately so that they can be open and usable on any device, if we think about accessibility a lot, students have their own devices, and why are we then buying a whole iPad cart when our students already have an iPad, right? I'm way more happy to use my own iPad than someone else's iPad, because I know how it's going to work. And my other comment about this is that I think our institutions also need to change, and they need to be more flexible and more agile. So it goes back to what Ken was saying about the journals, right? So some institutions have a course calendar that's it's online, but it's treated like a paper one. So you can only change it once a year. And we should be able to change it right now, anytime it's needed.
Oh. So, yeah, what all of them said, plus, it's ridiculously expensive. I totally agree. And in some cases, too expensive. And in some cases, they buy the expensive stuff, and they really shouldn't be doing that. Like buying iPads instead of tablets that you can get for, you know, less than half the cost and stuff like that. A lot of really bad decisions are made. And it's, you know, it's also the case that in a lot of the times, I've forgotten grammar for a moment there.
There are lots of teachers here to help you out.
Yes. A lot of the time, the application of technology in a school setting isn't really appropriate. It's not appropriate because the technology that's introduced isn't conducive to the methodology that's already in place in the school. And no doubt you can cite, and I know of cases, where technology was introduced, they got a cart full of iPads, they wheeled the cart into the closet, and that's where it sat for the remainder of the year. But there are many ways in which technology is cheaper. I mentioned the classics that my mother bought for me when I was young. I don't know what they cost, but I know that the financial impact on our family was significant, even for cheap Penguin paperbacks that fell apart on first reading. It was a lot. Now you can get that on Gutenberg for free. Cost you nothing. That's cheaper. So, and even if you have to buy a computer, which now costs about, for a netbook or something like that, you're outlaying $300, it's still cheaper to get these Gutenberg books. And you can get many more than just the Gutenberg classics. Tony Bates, who was cited earlier, wrote a book, now it's 10 years or more old, but it still applies, called Managing Technological Change. He did an analysis of the costs of online learning as compared to traditional learning. Now, he's writing from a distance education paradigm, so there's a lot of assumptions that we're making here. But basically what he showed is that the upfront cost for doing it online, yes, they're a lot higher for a whole bunch of reasons. After you hit a certain threshold, though, or the threshold you would never hit in a typical in-class setting, right? But after you hit a certain threshold of numbers of students, then the cost of online learning is significantly lower. One final point, and then I'll be quiet. And it was sort of alluded to earlier, and I want to draw it out and make it really clear. The really important thing about technology isn't doing the stuff you already did. It's the capacity to do things you couldn't do before. And that's not going to show up in your measurements, right? The math scores might go up, might go down, might be the same. There has been over time, MIT studies notwithstanding, something called the no significant difference phenomenon. This is the result of hundreds and hundreds of studies. You can look up that phrase, and they say the technology makes no significant difference in the pedagogical outcome. But what you can do are things that you could never do. You can practice video recording. You can speak to somebody who's living in Croatia, so on and so forth. You imagine all this stuff for yourself. And that's where the real impact is. That's where you get your ripple effects.
Great. Okay. All right. I'd like to say thank you very much. Yes, thank you. I'd like to say thank you to all of you for coming today. I'd especially like to thank our panel. We are out of time. I just had a couple closing comments, and these are obviously not detailed because I've been listening, I've been looking for some overriding types of themes. And I think this is the discussion that's so enriching and interesting to listen to different perspectives as well. So I really appreciate that. Thank you very much for bringing that to us today. A couple of the things that I would just like to say is really from this panel, the need for continued collaboration between levels of government, between instructors themselves, between learners themselves. Collaboration is a really important piece. And the idea of viewing language, this is a curiosity for my own personal area of interest, is language is really a fluid evolutionary process with the incorporation of some of those digital features as well as emoticons and all of that. So that's a very interesting piece that I think that I would like to take away. And the other idea too is the idea of new ways of encouraging interaction and collaboration. So whether we're doing it through personal learning environments, whether we're doing it through annotated literature pieces. And just it's a new way of kind of communicating in this new digital world where we do have to deal with some of these digital pieces, whether we're dragged kicking and screaming into it or whether we readily accept it. So obviously we've got lots of perspectives. I think there's a fantastic opportunity to have these discussions. I personally was very excited to have this opportunity to listen to all of these perspectives. So I'd really like to say thank you again very much for all of your insights and your knowledge and expertise. So thank you very much. Okay, and Glenn was, we were coordinating this together, so Glenn.
Thanks. Just for me, just to add on to what Wendy said, infrastructure was a really key theme for me. I heard it mentioned a lot. I think that's the foundation of almost everything that we've been talking about here. Stephen, Bonnie, Amy, Ken, thank you very much. Ken, if I can borrow your metaphor of the rock in the lake. When we put together this panel, that's kind of what we thought. It might not be the biggest event on Saturday at 4 o'clock, but we were seeing it as a rock in the lake, and hopefully the next conference, the conference after that, will continue with a panel like this and the waves that hit the shore. Thank you.
Technically, I'm teaching the teachers to make the